with tight lips and no smile and a red cup in her hand.
But you weren't there at the track meet. Why not at the track meet?
Because I needed self-care. I didn't get in.
You didn't get into...
To Harvard.
Oh my God, I'm sorry, Meredith.
Neeru, what the fuck?
She says, and leaves her lips parted with her disbelief. Where have you been?
I've been here.
Not as my friend, you haven't. You avoid me after class. I text, you don't text back. I call, you don't call back. I called you today, I say. The boys have gotten louder. They are on a new level, and we can hardly hear ourselves above the drink, 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 and all the cheers. She pulls me upstairs, and I stumble, so she stumbles. The carpet is soft against the hand that catches me. We're on a new level, and it's quieter, so I feel like deja vu.
What's wrong with you, Neeru? Did I do something else?
I said I was sorry, she says as she rolls her diamond and speaks in a small voice that I almost can't hear. I can see her face clearly now, and how it's twisted and pained beneath her eyeshadow and lip gloss. Every time I tell you something, something goes wrong.
What did I do now?
You told Rowan.
Huh?
She says. Her mouth is an O, like she is confused, but there is no sound. She says,
I don't get it.
You told Rowan about me. I know you did.
I didn't say shit to Rowan. Why would you say that?
My stomach turns and turns. Her red cup quivers in her hand between her gold and purple painted fingernails, and her face is red. Then why did he say so to me in the locker room? Before the meet, you skipped because you care for yourself.
I can't believe you think I would tell Rowan.
Then how would he know?
I don't know.
Stop lying.
Fuck you, Neeru. Just fuck you.
She says, and she is crying a little as she twists her diamond to her lips, as she backs away and turns around so I see her bare shoulder blades beneath the thin spaghetti straps. Her freckled skin makes me angry, so angry, and my stomach turns as the white boys downstairs fuck up some commas, laughing at black boys like me but with bad grammar. Meredith, I shout and burp and feel a wave of hot alcohol breath and bile rise and pull and subside, just like when I was 4. And all I wanted, all I ever wanted, was just to have some coke. But she is starting down the steps until she is not, because my hand circles her arm and her bare skin feels strangely warm, even if her muscles are hard and frozen.
You can't just fuck everything up, literally everything, and just walk away.
She is scared. Her eyes flash across my face, looking for something in my face to help her decide. Threat or not? Fight or flee? Inhale, breathe. You, yes me, I, not her, am the victim here.
I clutch my hand to my belly and squeeze her arm for support, because all these things are too much to stomach all alone, especially in the twisting and tilting and the rising noise coming from below.
Let me go, she says.
She says,
let me go. I didn't make you gay.
This world is so unfair, so very unfair, my knotted stomach says to my brain, and to my hands, which clench around her flexed muscles.
But now with anger, and as her eyes search my face again, now with rage.
Well, maybe Harvard didn't take you because you're a lying ass face. There is no more color in her face, and then I cannot see her face because my eyes burn. But I hear her red cup crack. And I hear Rowan cheer, drink, 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 even if I cannot see through the pain or hear through all the voices. Swallow it down,
swallow it down, swallow it down.
This rage, swallow me down from this embarrassment, this misery, from all these surrounding faces that can look but can't see what has happened, what she has done. Fight or flee? Now that I can see only one way out away from here. From these white boys and white girls and their what's up my nigga madness. Past Adam and his red-nailed, glitter-gloss-lipped appendage, and Rowan's curious, hateful, beady eyes, through all the bodies giving pounds, throwing up high fives, until the doors open to let me away with speed so I can run. Yes, really run. Away into the darkness before me. Into this night where the air stings my face. I need to stop and really breathe. No such luck. My legs carry me through this world of swirls. Wobbling this way, that way. Lurching left, correcting right. Tripping over my own imaginary untied shoelaces like some oversized toddler mid-tantrum. I mumble to myself through my own stiffness and tears about myself. About the world, as my whole body burns. Then there are so many lights, and so many bodies. Some arm in arm, on the brick sidewalks in front of the shops and banks, and more shops and restaurants on M Street, with the college students in skinny jeans that make their butts look big and their ankles small above their sneakers and boots, and the medical students, and law students, and graduate students, and yuppies who wear dress shoes as casually as they can, all walk. It all makes my head hurt, and my head spin, and my stomach churn like I am nervous. But I am not nervous. Not here. Not anymore. Not now. All that has been said has been said. What more can be spoken? I am tired and nauseous. I stop to rest against a lamppost while the people on foot and in cars and buses pass me by. My shoelaces have come undone, and my intestines are unraveling. The sidewalks undulate with each step, and cars rumble around me. I can feel it before I smell it, and then smell it before I taste it. The cold shiver and prickling, then the acid hot burn of the vodka and the coke that rises to force me to my knees, and then the purge, and the purge, and the purge. Are you okay? Of course you're not okay. Nah, nah, stay down, stay down, says a voice that comes at me from every direction, and I want to stay down, but can someone tell me which way is down? There are so many shoes. Jordans, boots, loafers, cream-colored high heels, and then Jordans closer. Attached to ankles, wrapped tight in skinny jeans. Should we call an ambulance? I think he needs an ambulance. No, I want to shout. No ambulances. They are for the sick and the dead. And I am still living. Not dead, even though I will be, if my parents have to leave whatever function they attend to find me lolling about a cot in an emergency room in clothes stiff with my own dried vomit. I stand up. I am fine. I'm okay. But I'm not okay. You're a hot mess, say the Jordans. My vomit pools in the dip of the sidewalk. The Jordans step back, and I wipe my hands against my pants until they are no longer sticky. No hospital. No, please. No, I'm okay. He's gonna be all right. No ambulance? Nah. I don't think, gosh, these kids think they can just come to this neighborhood and do whatever. We should really call the police. Nah, no need. Do you know him then? The voice is angry for no reason. Like everything is too small for everybody all at once and only the strong survive. I'm calling the police. Let them take care of him. It's okay. I got him. Can you stand? I can stand. In your arms? Yes, yours. If you hold me, I think. but my mouth doesn't move because his face is so concerned and kind with his light brown, almost green eyes, and his voice so soft and familiar.
Can you walk?
I can walk if you hold me, if you hold my hand in your hands and lead me.
I work in this store right here. We've got a bathroom in the back. I'ma help you back there, and you can clean yourself up. Can you walk?
I can walk, I think.
The bathroom is small, with air full of freshener and disinfectant, fancy soap in a fancy bottle, something organic, something environmental, perched on the rim of a sturdy industrial sink. I grab the sink. I hold on to the sink as more of my life forces itself out of me. I want to rinse my mouth, but the top looks rusted, and the rush of water looks full of rust and heavy metals. My face burns, and my lips burn. I touch two fingers to the flow, and then to my lips. The rich man begged God from hell to let Lazarus slake his thirst with just two drops, but God said certain torments are eternal. I dab at my forehead with my wet palms. I wet paper towels and scrub the vomit on my clothes.
Stupid. You are stupid, my father would say, because no son of his could do the things I've done, the things I do.
I can't see straight enough to see one version of myself in the scratched mirror before me, and I can't think straight enough to remember where I put my keys. This pocket or that pocket. This pocket, yes. And my car? I slam my palms against the wall.
Again.
The skin turns pink.
You are not like these white children,
my mother says, except on my palms that turn pink like their skin turns pink, but only when hurt or scared or stressed. There are taps on the door. Are you okay in there?
I'm okay, just a minute,
someone says, and that someone is me. Take your time. No problem. Just wanted to make sure you're still alive in there. That you hadn't collapsed, 'cause that would be bad.
I'm okay. I'm fine.
I put a change of clothes on the floor out here if you need them.
Thank you so much.
My shoes stink of vomit, even in all the air freshener and antiseptic and soap. I take them off and hold the tops beneath the gushing faucet. Outside the door are folded gray sweats. Then I am naked. Then I wear the sweats and feel their fuzz against my skin, against my chest and my back and my inner thighs.
You have to get under control.
I hear myself tell myself as I take my phone and wallet from my vomit-streaked pants and slip them into the pockets of the sweatpants.
Yes.
Yes,
myself agrees.
The self in the mirror, his red eyes swim in liquid and they bulge from his face.
What a horribly ugly face. What a stupid, simple face with its open mouth and big glazy lips shining with drool.
Close your mouth. Don't be a gollywog,
my father used to say.
Don't be a big-lipped gollywog.
But I didn't know what that was. It sounded sweet and friendly, but now I see myself. I know what that means, and I can't look any longer.
Idiot. Abomination. Not myself, not my father's son. Nothing. Nobody to no one.
Nonce. You good? He asks me, with lips so full and eyes drowned by concern. I touch my chest.
I can't pay for these. No money, I say.
Don't worry, seriously. I shuffle to the front of the store, very unsteady. It all takes so much effort, each step a separate command and each action a deliberate thought.
Now move, Niru. Now stop. Now breathe.
There is no vomit on the sidewalk. Someone has washed me away.
Can you get home?
He asks. His skin is soft brown, and his hair wavy jet black.
My heart stops. Home? Where is home?
I feel sick again. The world spins again. It's all right. It's okay.
Do you have a license?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir, in my pocket.
Do you have a phone?
Yes. Yes, sir, in my other pocket.
Damn. I ain't seen one of these in years. What's this?
It's a phone.
No, this is a call-making device.
He is funny, but if I laugh, my stomach swims, and if my stomach swims, I will vomit again.
I'll get you an Uber.
You don't have to.
Oh, I do. You're a hot mess.
I'm so sorry.
No problem. We've all been there.
But have we?
Then there's an Uber with black doors and gray pleather seats. The satellite radio speaks in Amharic to the driver, who looks at me through his rearview mirror. He asks, what's the best way to go? I say, I don't know, as I slump down in the back seat, crack the window, and feel the cold air wash over me. The house is dark when we pull up, and I remember the spare key under the mat at the basement door. My sneakers squish as I cross the lawn. I sit down to remove them, because I don't want to soil my mother's carpets. I touch my forehead to the cool glass door panes, and stare into the darkness to see what waits for me.
Chapter 7. I can't remember his face, but I think about him before I sleep. Sometimes it's his eyes, sometimes his hands. Sometimes it's Jordan's, sometimes his voice. I know him only in fragments, and I can't erase those fragments. They torment me. I say nothing to Reverend Olumide, who tells me that he is thrilled with the progress we are making. He says the struggle to live with the Lord is lifelong and constant. He tells me to pray always for deliverance.
You don't have to be alone in this, he says.
The weather is warmer, so he wears short sleeves and shirts unbuttoned at the collar. He tells me to stay vigilant, that temptation will still come. He writes down Bible verses for me to read on white index cards in dark blue ink with letters almost as perfect as a computer's. I take the cards. Genesis chapter 4 verse 7, Luke chapter 5 verse 32. 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 18, and put them in my pocket without looking at them. I have a stack on a shelf in my closet. They remind me of all the things I should do. I don't do them. Instead, on days when practice ends early, I take the long way home, detouring through Georgetown and lodging myself in the slow-rolling traffic on M Street so that I pass the store where he works. From my car, I see the faceless mannequins in runners, spandex leggings, and neon sports bras, leaving exposed milky white mannequin midriffs. I see running shoes stacked high to the ceiling, and the trickle of white-haired men and old but fit women who can afford the 30% location markup on a pair of shoes. The workers wear black shirts. I see them in fragments through the crowded display case, an arm here, the back of a brown head, a ponytail. I want the whole. I'm drawn to the whole. But I drive on, overwhelmed by my embarrassment. My sneakers curve upwards like banana boats because I ran them through the wash. My father wanted to buy a new battery for my car after I told my parents that I took an Uber home when the engine wouldn't start. He insisted on coming with me to retrieve it from school, and frowned with confusion when the car started immediately after I turned on the ignition.
Maybe it's the spark plug, he said.
I said, we should get home and look at it there. I had a headache, and my stomach still felt uneasy. My father followed close behind me in his Range Rover. My palms were sweaty against the steering wheel. Each time I pass, I tell myself that tomorrow I will stop. But when tomorrow comes, I don't stop because I'm scared. The devil always comes in fragments until you experience eternity in its consuming entirety, Reverend Olumide says. I say the next day I will stop because random acts of kindness should not go unrecognized. But the next day comes, and I can't piece together what I would say to those eyes, and I drive on, past the Key Bridge and up MacArthur Boulevard, where I roll down my windows and inhale the spring smells of wet earth and new leaves, and sometimes scream into the passing wind so that my voice is hoarse and my throat sore when I get home.
"Since when did you start drinking so much tea?"
my mother asks me.
"Every day, tea, 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 as if tea is going out of fashion," she says.
But I know she is secretly proud because she likes that I am adopting one of her British habits. Meredith would know what to do, but we don't speak anymore, so I can't ask her for help. Instead, we sit across from each other in global literatures, trying desperately not to look like we're not looking at each other. She is different now. Her skirts and shorts are shorter now, and she wears more makeup. Rowan tries not to look like he's looking at her, and Adam teases me after class.
"Dude, you should totally hit that. You saw her cross and uncross her legs. It's like basic instinct," he says. "You know, the movie with Sharon Stone."
He likes movies, so I nod and smile as we walk, and he bounces. Rowan pulls fraying threads from the bill of his Princeton hat, but he says nothing. I want to hate him, but it's a waste of time. He wouldn't give a fuck anyway. I text Meredith with my Nokia, cycling through letters and numbers with excruciating slowness, and I hope she knows this means I'm serious. She doesn't respond. I call Meredith after class, but she ignores me. During my free period, I walk up Wisconsin Avenue to the drugstore to look for blank greeting cards and dum-dums. An older white woman with thin gray curls and wrinkles, badly covered by too much makeup, rings me up. She smiles at me when she scans my items, and while the register beeps, she says,
"I know it's spring when you boys start coming here with your blazers looking for candy. In my day, the boys gave us flowers."
I smile and swipe my card quickly.
"I hope she's worth it," she says with a wink.
My father thinks all white people in service jobs are stupid, bitter, and mean, but she seems perfectly normal, maybe a little sad. I draw stick figures in comic book squares on every available surface of the greeting card. They talk about when we were younger, and we killed time doing silly things like staring directly into the halogen bulbs at the base of the cathedral and then stumbling about blinded by faith, Meredith said. I drew all the waiting after orchestra for our parents to come, while Lonnie, the Bahamian security guard, asked us,
"Your parents coming soon?"
I leave it on her sports bag during practice. "Is it too late to say I'm sorry?" I write. "Meet me after practice in the meadow," I text, but Meredith doesn't come to the meadow. Not after 15 minutes. Not after the street is empty and all the boys have gotten into their cars and gone home, leaving me standing in the perfect grass, alone. There are still colored streaks in the sky when I leave. The sunset shimmers in the windows of the Russian embassy and the storefronts lining Wisconsin Avenue so that the whole city looks like stained glass. OJ loved evenings like this, when the world seemed perfect, and he would drive us home playing underground hip-hop, rapping along softly while tapping his thumbs against the wheel. But he hasn't been here for some time, and normally he is too busy to talk on the phone. I know that my parents have told him nothing of the last few months, my mother out of concern for me, my father for shame, both because OJ needs to focus if he wants to become an orthopedic surgeon, and my issues are an unwelcome distraction. I dial his number and listen. Somewhere in New York, Call Tyrone plays, and my brother either ignores it or is busy. His half-Nigerian girlfriend gifted him the ringtone. She is also a medical student, so my mother is willing to overlook her whiteness. She called my mother to wish her a Merry Christmas. She texted me, too. They go to church on the Sunday mornings they aren't in the hospital. I cut the phone before it goes to voicemail. No, he wouldn't understand. There is a part of me that wishes Sport Zone would burn down, leaving nothing but a sticky mess of rubber soles and melted mannequins with blistered and charred skin. But the only one capable of incinerating problems is God, and almost everyone who matters in my life tells me that God is not on my side. I know I should go home right away, because that's what is expected of me. That's what OJ would do, what good sons do. There are normal things that normal people do at normal times. I heard my father tell OJ once when he called a girl his girlfriend. OJ was 13, so he sat in the front seat of my father's car. I was 7, so I sat in the back, like I wasn't even there. I played with the straps on my backpack as we sped home. OJ squirmed, like he wanted nothing more than to leave right then, forget the cars and moving vehicles driving by. His fingers slid against the silver door latch, then under it as his hand tensed to pull it back. But he let it go. I don't fight battles I can't win, OJ tells me when I complain about our parents. It makes life less difficult. I park beneath a dogwood tree on 32nd Street. Its smell immediately fills the car. Someone on the girls' track team called them cum trees. She said their blossoms smell like semen. I wonder how many people put our noses to that dip between our index fingers and thumbs that night. The name stuck, and now dogwoods make me think of sex. Thinking about sex is normal, Reverend Olumide says, but certain kinds of sex are not. Pray for strength. Pray for deliverance. Petals fall from the tree when I shut the door. A light breeze shakes more loose. The car will be covered with them by the time I get back, but there are no other parking spots. I'm out of options. I hesitate at the glass door to Sport Zone while the mannequins watch me with their hands on their hips and brand new running shoes on their feet. Inside, bright fluorescent light floods over sportswear neatly folded on industrial metal tables. Different shoe styles climb the wall on small wooden shelves arranged by brand, purpose, and pattern. Darks at the bottom, light colors at the top. Their distorted reflections shimmer in the high-gloss concrete floor. A lone salesgirl with a microphone earpiece and a soccer player's ponytail leans on a compact stand with an iPad for checkout. She looks at me, briefly less bored, but also trained well enough to know that my purchasing power is not worth adjusting her perkiness level. "How can I help you?" she says. I scan the store, but there is no one else inside. I can't remember much from my first time inside, except for the colors and the cold air forced down with a hiss from the exposed vents above. I wanted to take a look at some running shoes, I say. "Knock yourself out," she says. I do need new shoes. My current pair are less malleable after their session in the washer-dryer, but I've been afraid to ask my parents for money. I don't want to ask them for anything. I lift a neon blue trainer with red reflective stripes from its platform and turn it over. $180. "Everything in the store is 30% off," a voice says. I freeze like I have just stepped on a glass shard. He is shorter than me, and he has a fresh shape-up, well-oiled so the sharp line of brushed forward hair contrasts sharply with its brown skin. I swallow at his confused smile. Focus. But that smile. But those eyes. Focus. He has seen me, really seen me, and still his gaze is insistent. Do I smell? Yes, I smell. But he has already smelled the worst of me. This is torture. What beauty. A solid frame of sculpted arms and broad chest made all the more broad by his fitted black golf shirt. Collar popped. Focus. On what? Straight ahead to his face? But those lips. Say a prayer to slow this fast-beating heart. But his strong, delicate hands. To wet this dry mouth. But the soft slope of his nose. for deliverance. You're back, he says now, settled fully into his smile and this secret familiarity. Feeling better? He has such a wicked smile, with perfect teeth and just the right amount of arrogance. I feel the shoes slip from my sweaty hands as my legs grow weak. Well, you came to the right place for shoes, he says. How much running are you planning on doing? Here, have a seat, and maybe I can help you find something. Then shoeboxes surround us as he talks to me about running. He says his name is Damien, and that he studies dance at Howard University, but he wants to move to New York to dance with Alvin Ailey. I don't know what that is, but I nod all the same. He watches me as I walk around the store, weaving through the metal tables with a different style of shoe on each foot. He asks me how they feel, but I can't feel anything at the moment. Like I'm floating, I say. Which one? He asks. I point to the neon blue shoe with red stripes, even though the instep feels narrow. Good, he says. Trust your judgment. He squats down in front of me to probe for space between my toe and the front of the shoe. You don't want it to be too snug, so your feet can expand the more you run. If you're sure, I can get them from the back, he says, as he scans the shoe with his phone. You can pay Lisa up front. The blonde-haired girl looks at me with greater interest when I approach, my debit card already in hand. I hope you found what you were looking for, she says, with a wide smile. I nod as she swipes my card and swivels her iPad so I can sign. My mother will ask me about the price. Then she will ask me if I think money falls from the sky like manna. When I look at Lisa, I can breathe freely again until Damien returns with the box and a smile. Thank you, I say as I back away from him towards the door. Out on the street, the traffic has thinned, but an older man in a Mercedes convertible plays Bob Dylan really loud. Buses lumber past, and a young woman in bright yellow shorts and pale legs jogs by. She is so skinny that her knees buckle outwards as she moves. No, the world has not changed. Someone taps my shoulder. Damien stands in front of me holding a small white square of paper that flutters with the evening breeze. You forgot your receipt, he says, extending his hand just as a car approaches from behind, setting his body aglow. My fingers touch his fingers as I take the paper. I see that he feels me. Thank you, I say again, and also for the other night. Don't mention it, he says. Have a good night. Then he is gone. I hold the paper as I walk back to my car. No, the world has not changed, but my arms quiver. I unfold it before I unlock the door. His number floats across the white strip, and I realize the smell of dogwoods doesn't bother me. Chapter 8. My new life begins with coffee. That is what Damien and I decided when I finally dialed the number on the receipt. I sat beneath the flying buttress holding my phone. It took 3 tries entering the 10 digits on my Nokia with trembling hands before the voice in my head saying stop was drowned out by the parade of young mothers and nannies and SUVs picking up their squeaking little ones from school. Carpe diem, bitches, Adam likes to say ever since we read Romeo and Juliet. I pressed send. He sounded like he had just woken up, and I imagined him laid out on white sheets in a white room with sunlight streaming in through large windows, white curtains billowing in the breeze. Then he sneezed. It's me, Nero. Oh, right. Nero. What's up? I just thought I'd call to... Thanks for calling. I thought maybe I got it really wrong. I held my breath and said nothing as an irate mother honked at another mother to please move. Yeah, I just wanted to say thank you for the shoes. They're perfect. That's cool. I said, cool. watching a lone kid with an oversized backpack shuffle the sidewalk a few paces ahead of his anxious father.
"Stay with me, Peter," the father yelled.
"Okay, well, I guess I'll talk to you later," he said.
"Can I see you?"
I said without warning, without thinking, surprising myself. He said, "Yeah, sure. Tomorrow, like around now?"
He asked, "Have you been to Trist? You'll like Trist."
Now I stand across 18th Street from my future, staring up at large brown letters boldly painted on a cream-colored pediment. The sun shines, so customers spill through sliding doors to sidewalk tables set beneath large red umbrellas. They pretend to work at laptops, but pay more attention to people walking up and down the sidewalk. "Carpe diem," I say, and step into the street. Inside, there are people everywhere, clustered together at communal tables, facing each other on mismatched chairs and sunk comfortably into sagging couches removed from living rooms and basements. The college students study each other and the street over their laptop screens and textbooks. They raise their phones to text every other minute. Other customer tribes claim the cafe's different quarters. There are Ethiopians at the round tables and hard benches near the bathrooms, and young mothers in the paired easy chairs with space enough between them to fit a stroller. The couches are full of young, single people, hoping to brush an attractive stranger accidentally on purpose while reaching down to the floor sockets to plug in their laptops or phones. And there is Damien, at the far end of the coffee bar that runs the length of the cafe. He sits on his hands, hunched over a book laid flat on the counter, between a half-eaten chocolate chip cookie and a glass of milk. He sees me in the mirror above the bar and smiles. He wears jeans with holes at the knees. His white t-shirt glows with sunlight reflected from the mirror across the bar, and he wears brand new red running shoes. I catch my reflection in the mirror. Rumpled khakis, wrinkled blue dress shirt, blazer. I could have tried harder.
"You're here," Damien says.
His voice rises and falls with a casual elegance that it doesn't have at Sports Zone. He closes his book and breaks off a piece of cookie. His actions are deliberate, nothing wasted in the flow of hand to cookie to mouth to glass of milk to mouth to dabbing away his milk mustache with a folded brown paper napkin. He pats the empty stool beside him and rests his chin on his fist while he watches me. I hesitate.
"You're new at this," Damien says. "Don't worry. It gets better."
"Does it?"
I ask.
"It did for me, once I left home."
Home is Newport News, Virginia, where his father is a plumber and contractor with his own business, and his mother works in the mess at the naval base in Norfolk. He has two older sisters, one in the Coast Guard, the other in the Army. His father wants him to join the Navy, wanted him to go to the Naval Academy or at least do ROTC. He thinks he might quit school altogether and move to New York to audition. "I want to dance," he says as he swivels back and forth in his chair, swinging closer to me each time until finally his thigh touches mine. I sit upright when he places his fingers on my knee and smiles.
"What about you?" he asks.
"Your parents know," I say.
The first thing I have said since ordering a glass of lemonade, now drained on the counter before me. I play with my straw and stir my melting ice cubes until there is enough water to drink. Again, my mouth feels dry. Damien shakes his head.
"Does it matter?" he says.
"I'm not there. Maybe I'll never go back."
"But you'll have to go back at some point."
"We all have to die at some point," he says.
"So what's your point?"
"I'll deal with that when it's time."
He squeezes my knee and points at the clock. The clock says I have less than 10 minutes to get to practice. I search my pockets for the $20 bill my mother gave me for gas this morning.
"Don't worry," he says.
"I ate a salad before you came."
"But I owe you," I say.
"Next time," he says.
There is no one to tell how his eyes really are green, and that Damien has incredibly smooth lips and killer dimples. There is no one to laugh with about his cookies and milk, to gush to about the fact that he is 18, like I am 18, only he seems much older. He has more facial hair, which he keeps perfectly trimmed, and he works 2 jobs at 2 different sports stores, because no one is paying for his college but him. There is no one to talk to about waiting for his call, because I've told him not to text me ever. And feeling my heart stop when my phone rings, and it's his voice. And again, when an hour has passed, and our words have filled our ears, and still not enough has been said. There is no one to speak to about my headache and my stomach ache when I leave my bedroom and encounter this beautiful prison that my parents have built. When I see pictures of me on the walls and side tables that bear no resemblance to the me they cannot see. Sometimes I stare at the family that owns me, and I wish I were a different person, with white skin, and the ability to tell my mother and my father, especially my father, to fuck off without consequence. And sometimes I stare at the white cards of Bible verses Reverend Olumide has gifted me, and I think that there is still a chance to change my ways. When we sit in his office, I talk to him about my future, about college and possible careers. I say nothing about the rest of my life, so he thinks his pronouncements and prayers are working. I flex my abs while he speaks to force myself to breathe through the nausea and the pounding in my head. And when I leave, I call Damien so that he can tell me it gets better. "Can I see you?" I ask.
"I'm not invisible," he laughs.
It's our joke now. Just like the end of the bar is our spot now, and that 2 hours between lunch and track is our time for cookies and milk and quick but soft brushes against each other's knees and bare arms. When I touch him, he smiles. When he touches me, I jump and look around to see if anyone has noticed. I'm nervous, but after seeing him, I hit my speed workouts harder, and Coach Erickson is pleased. After seeing him, I don't think too much about Meredith or the fact that I've seen her talking to Rowan after class more, and the fact that he likes to say her name in the locker room and talk about her ass. Meredith has no ass, and she knows it, too. We used to laugh about that when we still laughed about things together. Now our eyes sometimes catch, but it isn't laughter, we see. "She was my best friend," I tell Damien as he eats his chocolate chip cookie. "But now we don't really speak."
"I don't speak to anyone from my high school." "Fuck 'em." "I was like, bye-bye," Damien says.
"The world is too big a place." "Except that I'm still in high school," I say. "And it sucks to be surrounded by people who live for their silly parties on Friday nights."
"You mean what you were doing when I met you?" he says with that wicked smile, that all-knowing smile and wall of teeth primed perfectly to hold back secrets, to let them go if they should choose. "I'm just playing," Damien says.
"You can relax."
His hand rubs my back.
"You can relax," he says, and his palm touches my face.
"There are first times. Seriously," he says.
I say, "Seriously, man, you're in college. You're free. You don't know what it's like being trapped anymore. I go to school and it's just me. I go home and it's just me."
"But you come here and it's also me," he says.
His hands are on my hands, on my knees that I bounce nervously.
I look at the clock.
"I have to go,"
I say, and begin to gather the books and papers I bring to make myself think that people, if they are watching, see this for something other than what it is. But I'm a senior, and this is spring. Work has lost its meaning. "Did I say something wrong?" he asks.
"No, it's just, I'm just frustrated. This feels so odd. There is never enough time. It's not ideal."
"Then let's make more time," he says, and he gets up when I get up. Most afternoons, he simply waves goodbye.
Today he walks me around the corner to the alley where I parked my car. It is empty, except for an agitated cat that circles a dumpster, meowing. I like spending time with you, so I spend the time there is to spend. I like the way you feel, but I know it scares you to feel me. Sometimes it scares me too, he says. He laughs, but I don't. So I enjoy the little you let yourself be touched. There's nothing ideal, so I see no reason to complain. I have one foot in the car and the other planted firmly on the ground. Damien folds his arms over the door between us. The small diamond studs in his ears catch the sunlight. You think too much, and it makes you feel alone, he says. We're different. I can't not think, and I'm nowhere near as strong as you, I say. I can't just tell my parents, my friends, everybody to go away. What's left for me? Damien says, the world. His face is insistent. You're stronger than you think, he says, with eyes wide and full of light, his brow arched and his lips pressed together. These are the fragments of a face that got me an Uber home, and they are everything. I want to touch him, to sneak my fingers toward his fingers, put my hands on his hands, and let my skin rub his skin. I want to put my lips to his lips, but my only experience with that is Meredith, and I am still scared by the idea of being completely connected to something so separate, so much a part of something that is completely me and also not me. A kiss is the ultimate uncanny, Miss McConnell said in class after we read The Passion. Simple and pure, driven by lust, a separation that knows no boundaries. You are not fully yourself, and yet you are totally self-aware. Damien moves towards me, and all I can think is, I don't want this door to be here. But nothing is ever ideal. His lips brush my lips too quickly for me to feel shame, too fast to feel indecent, too fast. Then everything is slow, and I feel him fully, and my body stiffens, my body melts, and I want to say stop, but those salty lips, but that searching tongue. The cat meows. I bring my hands to my lips to see if they are still mine. They tingle and buzz. Oh my God, I say. I have to go. Damien doesn't say a word. Sin is a slippery slope, Reverend Olumide says to me when I see him next. My hand goes to my lips because I think he knows. He sits on his couch with his legs crossed and his arms stretched across the backrest while I perch on the edge of the facing armchair. Of course he doesn't know, and yet he is still a man of God. They can sense these things. There is a rainbow-colored mix of peanut M&Ms in the bowl on the table between us. Reverend Olumide holds a few in his fist, which he pops into his mouth at regular intervals. It's like these candies I just can't stop eating, he says. You put one in your mouth. Then you want another, and another, and another. Before you know it, you've eaten the whole bag. Your teeth are rotting and about to fall out. Your mouth smells like decay, he says. They are so good, but it's my choice to walk the path of righteousness or to not and continue to shuffle along in the darkness. That's God's greatest gift. This doesn't feel like a choice. It never did. But now I feel like things are completely beyond my control. His kiss? I crave it. I need it. I think about it. Now when we meet, we kiss frequently. We make out. Sometimes I kiss with my eyes open just to make sure this is real. It is real, but always so short. He tastes of chocolate chips on some days, ginger tea on others. I want to ask him what I taste like, but I'm embarrassed. I keep Tic Tacs in my pocket and Listerine strips in the glove box. Sometimes he is delicate with me, tentative, like he wants to see if I really want it. It drives me crazy. My neck tingles and my chest burns. I press myself to him. I pull him towards me and we tumble down that slippery slope on the secluded benches in the darker corners of Meridian Hill Park, while the Guatemalans and Salvadorians practice their patriotism on the dusty soccer field in front of us. Other days, when he has come from or doesn't want to go to a shift at work, he is wild, sucking away everything I thought I knew about the way I'm supposed to be in this world. I feel like a star caught in the gravitational pull of a black hole, unraveling, spinning under the control of some unseen force, torn into streams of fire, forever spiraling, never to be put together again. But I still take the white index cards Reverend Olumide hands me, and I mumble good morning and good night to my parents. I pretend not to notice Meredith pretending not to notice me, though she forgets herself and smiles at me across the room when Ms. McConnell talks about Teju Cole and the African imaginary. She knows I know she has kissed Rowan. I want to ask her how he tastes, but I won't speak to her until she speaks to me. I also have pride. We can feel summer and graduation. Adam dares the teachers by purposefully not wearing a tie. Rowan copies Adam, and soon all the seniors are an army of defiance. We watch the underclassmen scramble home, weighted down by backpacks full of textbooks and novels, as they moan about papers they have to write and exams that we don't have to take. We lounge by our cars and skip class to make runs to McDonald's or the gourmet pizza place across from it on Wisconsin that everybody knows, but nobody remembers its name. There are girls' school versus boys' school water fights, where the boys try to get the girls' t-shirts wet. But the girls are smart and wear bikini tops beneath their school clothes. Sometimes I participate when Adam says, "Yo, Harvard, you coming?" But mostly I slip away to Sports Zone in Georgetown so I can spend time with Damien on his break. He works endlessly now because he wants to spend the summer in Los Angeles at a dance studio perfecting his hip-hop. He shows me video after video of their choreography on YouTube. Sometimes he tries to get me to do it with him in the park. "See, over there, I can be me," he says. I smile, but it makes me sad. I haven't found any safe spaces. Damien says, "You're safe with me." "Until I'm not," he raises an eyebrow. "With you, I mean," I add. I dream about an internship on the West Coast, but there is nothing for me to do. I am not the president's daughter. I've never met a movie star. I barely watch television. "We could live together in an apartment in Venice Beach," Damien says while he strokes my hand as we sit in the park by the Potomac River, at the sundial in front of the Swedish embassy. The sunlight plays on the ripples stirred by the soft and silent current. "We can have an adopted cat named Gordon," he says. He kisses me. He has to move out of his dorm and into a friend's apartment before he goes to L.A. He says I have strong arms that should come in handy. "It's just by Meridian Hill Park," he says. "I mean, if you want to come." I want to, and I have nothing to do until track practice, so I say yes. His dorm room is a mess, and it's cold. Half-constructed boxes litter the floor. Overstuffed suitcases and duffel bags burp clothes from between zippers that refuse to close. There are no white curtains or white sheets or white walls. Everything is cream-colored cinder block with half-fallen posters of famous dance icons next to rappers and singers. His sheets have come off the bed at the edges, and his pillowcase needs washing. "Home, sweet home," he says. He says, "Fuck this place." Then he kisses my cheek. "Don't you have to pack?" I say. He puts my finger to his lips. Then he licks it, and I am all shivers and uncontrolled sensations. There are first times, and there is his bed. Uninviting, but available. I am not ready for this, but no time is ideal. And yes, his hot breath, and yes, his lips, and yes, something else. That thing that I have, that he has, that despite all the perfection makes this moment feel somehow very, very wrong. His hands are on my butt, and he grinds against me, and I feel him stiffen and shiver. "The slope is very slippery," Reverend Olumide says. "But so is the feel of his hard, bare stomach now that his shirt is off, and my hands can feel how it feels to be a dancer. It feels so good. But in eternity, the choices we make echo," Reverend Olumide says. And I see my father's face staring down at me from above, twisted with tears. "If there is eternity, I will certainly have hell to pay unless this is just me, truly me, and no stack of Bible cards can change that." But his strong, searching hands sliding lower, uncoupling the things that hold me in, wrapping themselves around me. "Stop, Damien. Stop it." "Stop what?" "Stop that." "But this wave that passes through me, I am possessed. It is everything. Stop, stop, stop. This is all wrong, all so wrong." "What's wrong?" he asks through his wicked smile as his arm moves faster. I push him back. "No." Then he is not smiling, and I feel so very exposed. "What's wrong?" he says. "I should go." "Niru, I don't understand." "I have to go," I say. "I just have to go." My head and my heart, my weak legs and the parts of me between now feel so drastically out of place. Outside, the world is still normal. The cars still honk at each other, and people still sweat while waiting for the bus. There are pigeons and sparrows cooing and singing and turning their incomprehensible mating dances. "Niru, what the fuck? Slow down and talk to me," Damien says. Gravel crunches beneath my sneakers as I walk through Meridian Hill Park to my car. "Slow down," he says. "I'm right here. I didn't mean to. I don't know." I stop beneath a tree. "I can't, Damien," I say. "I'm freaking out." My arms quiver. My legs shake. I can't feel my face. "Was that too much, too fast?" he asks. "I thought you wanted me to. I thought that's why you came. Why did you come?" The fountain is in full flare, sending water down the terraces to froth in the lily pad pond below. From this point, we can see all the way to the White House and all the buildings between, locked in place, unmoved. "I came because you have showed me something inside me that I can't control. Because now the world before, with its rules and requirements, is not enough, I want to say, but I cannot speak." "The first boy I kissed was a sailor," Damien says. "He was a white boy, skinny as hell. He was 19 and I was 16. He had just joined the Navy, but he had a girlfriend back in Missouri that he said he loved. He said he needed her, but he wanted me. He talked about her all the time like she was some kind of medicine. But he used to call me at night when everybody was asleep and tell me to meet him in parking lots. The first time we fucked, It was in a parking lot, in his truck. He liked to play trap music, and I let him fuck me.